John Brown's body lies a moldering in the grave, while weep the sons of bondage whom he ventured all to save. But though he sleeps, his life was lost while struggling for the slave. His soul is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory,
welcome glory, to War hallelujah. Of the Rebellion, Stories of the Civil War. I'm your host, Leon, and this is a reading of the history of the 72nd Indiana Volunteer Infantry of the Mounted Lightning Brigade. Chapter 12. October 6th to October 18th, 1862. General forward movement. Trunks set home. March to Shelbyville. First Graybacks. Songs for the Rebels and Blacks. Hard march for Frankfort. Skirmish on entering the city. First rebel blood. Into camp near the cemetery. 400 men for picket. March to Versailles. Capture of rebel soldiers. Arrived at Louisville October 5th. We found most of the troops gone, and learned that they had marched in the direction of Bardstown. The streets we left so thronged were almost empty. As soon as we got into camp, orders came to cook 2 days' rations for our haversacks, to put 4 days' raw rations into our wagons, and be ready to move early next morning. We had enough of Louisville, and were anxious to be off after Bragg, as we heard he was retreating. Our only dread was that horrible General Granger, who had almost worn us out on the Elizabethtown march. The very important order was also issued that line officers should dispense with trunks, and they all brought carpet bags and sent their meeting houses home, steeples and all. One trouble with Buell had been too much baggage train, too few ambulances. We were to have less baggage train and more ambulances from this time. It was a most important step in the right direction. On October 6th, about noon of as beautiful a fall day as one ever saw, we shouldered our knapsacks and guns and marched out on the Louisville and Frankfort Pike through a delightful country. We understood that we were going to Shelbyville, some 32 miles distant. Our march was again very rapid that afternoon, and we made 17 miles before going into camp on Floyd's Fork of Salt River. The water was very bad at this camp. Many men whose feet had been skinned on the Elizabethtown march had to fall out. But fortunately, now, and for the first time since we entered the service, we have ambulances with us to aid the men in keeping up with their regiments. On the 7th, the march was resumed, and we reached Shelbyville at 4 p.m., and went into camp on the grounds which a rebel force had occupied a few days before. We found, to our horror, before morning, that the ground was alive with graybacks, the name given by the soldiers to the army body louse. We had seen old soldiers picking them out of the bristles of their hog hair shirts, but we had never enjoyed that distinction, being too new. After this night, we were veterans, having received the finishing touch on that campground. And you ought to have seen a scratch. From that night, we could tell as big a yarn as any veteran, and do as much scratching to the square inch. On the 8th, we formed and marched into Shelbyville, where we remained until 1 p.m. While here the boys sang many patriotic songs, to the great annoyance of some bitter secessionists, near whose house we were halted. The one that made them maddest was, "Say, blacks, have you seen de massa, with the mustache or him face, go down de road sometime dis morning, like he's gwine to leap de place? He seen a smoke way up de river, whar de Lincoln gunboats lay. He took his hat and left Barry Satin, and I spee he's runned away. De massa run, ha ha. The black stay, ho-ho, it must be now, de kingdom comin', and de dear yar ob jubilee. This song delighted the blacks who had flocked to see us, as much as it exasperated the white rebels, and it was too funny to see the rebels raving in front yards, on porches, or at windows, while around the corners of the houses the blacks were rolling their great white eyes, bending their bodies and beating their woolly heads in deliriums of joy and laughter. They at once caught the melody and spirit of the song, and for their sake it was sung about a dozen times, and the tune stayed with them, and most of the words, too. When the brigade did start, it went almost in a run, as if our little General Granger had just aroused from a sleep, and realized that he was some miles behind. On we went over the hard pike at the rate of 3.5 to 4 miles an hour, halting but briefly once or twice until 10 o'clock of the night, when we were ordered to get over into a field, lie down on our arms, and go to sleep, which we speedily did. We knew we were within 6 miles of Frankfurt, and at that place, report had it, we would meet the rebels strongly fortified and be stoutly resisted by them. It is no boast to say that we were willing to meet the rebels, if it was their pleasure, and many expected it would be their pleasure to keep us out of Frankfurt. And we knew, if they made a stand at that place after burning the bridge, the city would have to be shelled and battered with artillery, as the river and bluffs would make it impossible to charge and take it at the point of the bayonet. After resting some 3 hours, we were called up by the long roll, told to see that our guns were ready for action, and hurried off. Many of us were so stiff and footsore, having lain down hot in the chill of the night, that we shuffled along like ducks after overeating pumpkin seeds. We could hardly lift our poor, swollen, blistered, peeled feet from the ground, or step more than 15 or 18 inches. Soon, after we started, the cavalry dashed by, and soon after that we heard the roar of cannon and a slight clatter of small arms in front. Our patriotic hair bristled, our blood had a quicker circulation, and we were ordered to take a double quick step, and did it at a lively rate, forgetting all about our sore feet for the nonce, not from fear, but desire for the fray. Historic license allows the last statement. We got in sight of the bridge over the Kentucky River at break of day. It was a long, covered structure. Our cavalry had charged upon the rebel pickets as the battery let a few shots fly over the city, and the rebels cut sticks and left, very sudden, and ran away, leaving a considerable part of their effects behind them. One rebel was killed in the charge on the bridge, and the blood was dark on the floor and the sides of it. This was the first rebel blood we saw. After sleeping around upon the pavements and cellar doors until about 8 a.m., we were marched to the top of a high hill east of town, near the beautiful cemetery, and went into camp. Our campground overlooked the city, which is built on a little table land on the riverbank, at the foot of towering hills that fence it in, and we could look right down into the penitentiary walls and see the convicts in their striped clothes at work. On the afternoon of the same day, October 8th, the 72nd furnished 400 men for picket. And it took so many of those able for duty that battalion drill was not possible until the pickets came back to camp. Our ranks were visibly thinned, and many of those ablest of body when the regiment was first formed had gone to the crowded hospitals, and some to the grave. Overmarching had done a terrible and sad work. While there was no large force of rebels in that section, there were many small bands, and skirmishing often occurred as we were establishing our picket lines. On this day, also, the Battle of Perryville was fought, and though full 40 miles away, we could hear the roar of the artillery. On the 11th of October, we were ordered to get ready to move as lightly as possible, with 2 days' cooked rations and haversacks. It was now evident that when any rapid movement was to be made, the 72nd had to participate. We were also fully posted as to what these orders to move light at a moment's notice, with cooked rations meant, and we laid aside every weight and big knapsacks which so easily upset us, and, each with a single blanket, rolled up as hard as a cable and swung around the shoulders, his gun, haversack, canteen, and tin cup, were ready before the order to move came, and quietly resting to the last moment. What a change from the first order to march at Lebanon, when it took some 50 teams to haul our camp equipage, and when we almost wore ourselves out getting ready, and were tired when we started. Here we all were, in an hour after receiving marching orders, fully ready and serenely waiting, and not a team to accompany us, save a few ambulances. At 2 p.m., the order march was given, and we moved out onto the Versailles Pike and faced for that town. We sailed along at a rate of over 3 miles the hour on a solid pike, and through a splendid country, part of the Bluegrass region. It was understood that our brigade was to make a dash on the rebel force at Versailles. Before 6 p.m., we entered the town having marched 14 miles in 4 hours, and hardly a man fell out by the way. All the rebel soldiers that were able fled the town at our approach. But we captured 300 sick and convalescent rebel soldiers and paroled them. We mingled with and talked freely to these prisoners, and most of them expressed themselves as glad to be captured. They represented the condition of the South as deplorable. The supply of food, and all other supplies in most of the rebel states, were about exhausted. Bragg had forced his way north, hoping to invade Indiana and Ohio, plunder food, horses, and etc. from them, to get heavy reinforcements from Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio, dishearten the North, and compel the Union government to ask for an armistice and a compromise. Instead of accomplishing his purpose, he was being driven back at every point, and his army, so lately full of vim, courage, and expectation, was now on the retreat to the destitute states disheartened and half demoralized. This news was bracing to us, who had a short time before been falling back before the same army, and we felt pretty well as we were now chasing them before us. It was Saturday evening as we entered Versailles, and it seemed that all the Negroes for miles around had assembled to see us march in. Their demonstrations of joy as we filed by them were enthusiastic, quite amusing and often touching. They shouted, danced, leaped, yelled, and prayed for us. One old lady expressed her delight by first yelling out a blessing on us, and then butting a gate post over and over, with all the force of an old ram. The boys asked for cornbread, and the Negro woman ran quickly and got all they had and brought it to them, and said, if you uns ill wait, we uns ill go and just bake cords of it for ya. But we uns could not wait. We camped overnight near the town, and the next morning extended our reconnaissance towards Nicholasville, 4 miles, took 10 prisoners, returned by the same road through Versailles, 2 miles on the Frankfurt Road, and went into camp. On this afternoon, the first Negroes that ever left their masters and followed us got down from the fences along the side of the road and joined the regiment. Most of them were returned to their masters. Next morning, we returned to camp at Frankfurt, but had not more than stacked our arms before we were ordered to draw 5 days' rations and be ready to march in the morning. When morning came, we were ready, but marching orders were countermanded. We remained in camp from the 13th to the 18th without incident. The weather was beautiful, and battalion and company drill was the daily routine. As long as we had been in the service, we had never seen a military funeral until the 15th of October. A soldier was buried who was followed by his grave by the fife shrieking out the dead march, accompanied by muffled drum, while comrades followed the slow-moving ambulance with reversed arms. When buried, shots were fired over his grave. All who witnessed it were deeply impressed with the solemnity of this unique funeral, and it was especially depressing on those who had a touch of the jaundice and homesickness, and for them the fewer such funerals they witnessed, the better. One day, while lying at Frankfurt, General Dumont met a 72nd man carrying a mackerel, and said, "My man, what have you got?" "I have a mackerel," said the man. "What do you intend to do with it?" asked the general. "I'm going to broil it and eat it. I've heard that broiled mackerel is good for the diarrhea." "Young man," said the general very gravely, "go broil that mackerel well. Eat it, and report the result to me. If it cures you, I will have a keg of mackerel issued to every man in the 72nd Regiment." All right. Let's get into some show notes. So we have our first slimming down of the regiment, which is excellent. They're getting into fighting shape, although it's coming at a cost. They say they're about down to around 400 gentlemen out of 1,000. That's pretty significant. But first, let's talk about graybacks. And if you're not familiar with the term that he's talking about, this is body lice, or pediculus vestimenti. They had other nicknames as well. Rebels, bluebellies, cooties. Yes, that's right, cooties. And my personal favorite, General Bragg's bodyguard. Oh, I'm so glad he was so terrible. All right. There are larger than normal lice that we all encountered during primary school from one time or another, and they could actually inflict a decent amount of suffering. If you had a very bad infestation, it could cause malaise from blood loss, or you could even get typhoid fever from them. One of the main ways soldiers became carriers of all of this body lice was from reusing camps that were infected with them from previous troops. And that's exactly what happens to the 72nd. And once you became infected, you could only manage the problem. You could not solve it. Whether it was boiling your clothes or singeing them in fire, they always came back, and it became a common duty amongst soldiers, big and small, from private to major general, to deal with them. And there are all sorts of very hilarious stories that soldiers talk about in relation to graybacks, whether it's leaving a shirt on the ground and seeing it move around because it has so many graybacks that are frantically looking for, you know, a human to feast on, and all sorts of stuff. So we are going to get through Hardtack and Coffee by John D. Billings. And he's got all sorts of great stuff in there. And that's just coming to the YouTube channel. I'm not releasing that as part of a podcast or anything. I just really like the book. It's one of my favorites. But anyway, so the next thing on this list is the song that was written down that was about slave owners running away from the Union Army. And they began teaching it to the slaves, who then began singing it. I wish so badly to have more information from the people that they taught it to. What happened to them, what they decided to do after that, once they kind of had that, I don't know, pick me up hurrah that was given to them, and what they ended up doing. So the language that he uses when African Americans are speaking, and the way that that song was written, is derived from racist connotations about Black Americans. It's very much a reduction to infidelism that white supremacy in America had done. I know that as this author, it doesn't seem like he's trying to portray them as that. But then again, maybe he does. As the saying goes, when people show you who they are, believe them. So, but it's a common trope that you see. Robert E. Lee was like this. This is kind of where lost causers and people who like them or whatever, you know, they just get their teeth kicked in. About Robert E. Lee, who wrote about slavery, obviously, up and before the war, and he wrote, quote, "The painful discipline they are undergoing," which is slavery, "is necessary for their instruction as a race, and I hope will prepare and lead them to better things," unquote. It's only a small piece of what he wrote, of course, and I'm personally being very selective, but this was a common belief that Americans had about slaves, was that they were such children they needed to be looked after or cared for. You see some of that even in modern rhetoric, and it's just not true. It's just made up. So, and how we know that is one of our wonderful founding fathers, humpaholic Benjamin Franklin. Old Benji, however, went to a Philadelphia school of black American children and said, wow, it's not who they are, it's their lack of education, after just sitting there watching them. So with the introduction of evidence, he changed his opinion. And I think that's what makes America great, is that we face our racial prejudice and tackle them head on. Even when we don't want to, we seem to be forced into it at times. So every time you see it or hear it, just think there's Benjamin Franklin sitting in the corner shaking his head in disapproval. And it was his wife that got him to go to that school. And that's why you should always be a wife guy. Anyway, that's just what I think every time I see that language, that Americans knew better. All right, let's move past that and on to their first engagement. They don't fight in it, but they're still a part of it. So the cav is on the move, the artillery's pounding away, and they get on the double quick. They arrive at the bridge, and they see blood of the first person killed so far in the war for them. And they're already down to 400 men. It's pretty interesting, isn't it? So I imagine it was a very sobering event, because that man was just like any of them. You or me woke up that morning and thought he was going to go to sleep that evening, and instead his life was taken. That's the disaster of war, is that it just takes life away at random, and you never know when it's your time. Everyone thinks that they will come home a hero, but I have not so far found in any case where anyone I know feels that way about their past service, except for those who have not returned. I know I still think about certain people I met in Afghanistan, little kids without limbs or children that their parents tried to sell me. And I'm interested to see when that realization of that hardness comes with the territory of being a soldier, after they start seeing their friends fall in battle, rather than just being carried off to the hospital. So we're going to move on to the Battle of Perryville. Very briefly brought up, I am not going to talk about the whole battle, not by a long shot, or even what happens. I am instead going to leave you with a quote from Colonel John Connell of the 17th Ohio, and this was written after the war at a reunion, and he says, quote, "What soldier under Buell will forget the horrible affair at Perryville, where 30,000 men stood idly by to see and hear the needless slaughter in McCook's unaided, neglected, and even abandoned command, without firing a shot or moving a step in its relief," unquote. Buell does not last as an army commander, just in case you are wondering. He has ended up relieved by Abraham Lincoln, essentially because he is just too slow. Man, real exciting times ahead for the 72nd, I'll tell you what. Oh my goodness. All right. For the last bit that is covered in this, which is regarding the eating of mackerel and diarrhea, I have this to say. The month of April has been designated as IBS Awareness Month by the International Foundation for Gastrointestinal Disorders to help focus attention on irritable bowel disease. Listed under foods to help you combat this is fish containing omega-3 fatty acids, salmon, sardines, and mackerel. Although, little did they know, they should just be drinking lots of water that had been just heated to a boiling point, but they didn't know it back then. So, all right. That's the end of my notes, my fellow mush eaters. Thank you for listening. I will leave you to it. And I will see you in the next episode. You will not hear or see anything from me over the next 4 days. I'm going to be very busy. My puppy has an injured paw, and I need to take him. He can't really stand on it very well, except for, of course, when the squirrels or the rabbits are out, and then all of a sudden the injured paw goes away and he's bounding all around trying to chase him. So he's got a date with the doctor, so I'm going to be quite busy with family and other events this weekend, so there'll be nothing at all coming up. But anyway, with that, my friends, thanks for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode. Bye-bye now.
Old John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, while weep the sons of bondage whom he ventured all to save. But though he sleeps, his life was lost while struggling for the slave. His soul is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Hallelujah, for his soul is marching on.